Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, how's your heart? Maybe on many levels, how's your heart? Not just health-wise, but also psychologically, and also just as a master of so much of the rhythms of your body. We want to have a happy heart and keep it from harming us and understand what it does to help us and how we can help it. And to do that better, I want to introduce the author of a book called Human Heart, Cosmic Heart. He's a doctor who has written this beautiful book, and I really want to recommend it to everybody to understand how hearts work so you can use yours better. It's a doctor's quest to understand, treat, and prevent cardiovascular disease. And I'm happy to have as a guest on Energy Stew, Thomas Cohen. Tom, welcome to Energy Stew.
Thank you. It's actually Cohen, not Cohen.
Yes, thank you. I had a feeling when I said that you were going to correct me. It's C-O-W-A-N, so people can get it right.
Like cow.
Right. Thank you. And you're a natural guy. You do a lot of farming, and and your background actually has a lot to do with Rudolf Steiner and Weston Price. And there's a lot about healthy meat and dairy in that setup. So this is really important that you are coming at this from a very natural place of understanding the heart differently than traditional doctors. And that's where I want to get going with you, because for one thing, you don't believe that the heart is the pump that keeps our blood going in our system. Not that it doesn't help, but it works actually in a different form, because people don't understand the form of the heart and why it beats the way it does. Can you explain a little of that?
Yeah. So what you're talking about is basically the role of the heart in the movement of the blood.
Right.
And I just want to point out, too, that because I realize that I'm saying things that are, let's just say, at the least controversial, and so I don't want anybody to just take my word for it. And we did create a website called humanheartcosmicheart.com, and for instance, what I'm about to say, there are two articles posted there under news, one by a mechanical engineer and the other by a cardiac anesthesiologist, both of which address this in, you know, much more detail with references than obviously I can do in 10 minutes. So if for those of you who are gluttons for engineering and scientific punishment and want to, you know, go into the details of pressure waves, et cetera, that does exist. I don't necessarily get into that so much, but you can find that with references. The whole idea of this comes about, and it's very important to be clear on the wording here. When I say the heart is not a pump, I mean that the usual way of looking at this is the contraction of the walls of the heart. In other words, particularly the left ventricle, which, quote, pumps the blood through the body. And that what the normal way is saying is it's the squeezing of the walls of the ventricle that create the pressure that causes the propulsion of the blood through the body. That's what I mean by a pump. That model is so blatantly, let's use the word ridiculous, that it doesn't meet any of the criteria for what they're trying to explain. And what I mean by that is, if you look at the circulation as a whole, you realize that you have this extensive series of tubes called blood vessels. First, there's the arteries, which carry the oxygenated blood, and then the capillaries, which are the transition vessels, and then the veins, which bring the deoxygenated blood back to the heart. So depending on how you arrange it, if you lay them out side by side, it would cover, I think, approximately about 3 football fields. And if you lay them out end to end, it would actually encircle the earth 3 times. So that's an extensive series of tubes. And then we have this approximately 1-pound organ with a interesting arrangement of muscle fibers in the left ventricle. It's not at all like any other sort of normal pump. It's these arrangement of fibers so that the apex, the part that you would expect to generate the most pressure is literally a 1 muscle layer thick, meaning it's about the size of a tissue paper. And then other places, it's 7 layers thick. And the idea is this 1-pound, mostly thin-layered muscle is supposed to pump very sticky fluid with stuff suspended in it, meaning red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets, that are interestingly about the same size as the diameter of the tube, meaning the capillaries. And so this 1-pound organ is supposed to push this fluid, sticky fluid, all the way 3 times around the earth. Now, I don't know about you, but but actually it's even more preposterous than that, because it turns out, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah. It turns out it's even kind of wackier than that, because it turns out that let's just say we're pushing from New York to California. It's actually longer than that, but just to give you a visual image. So it turns out that halfway through this journey around from New York to California through these series of blood vessels, so around St. Louis, the blood actually stops, which is what it does at the capillaries, and it exchanges blood and gases and food and picks up waste products, et cetera, and then it gets going again. And then it goes faster and faster as it approaches New York from San Francisco. So in other words, the pump model says you can pump through all this sticky fluid with stuff floating in it through narrow tubes, unlike any other hydraulic system in the world, by the way. And it can stop halfway through, and then it gets going again, and the entire motive for the movement is from the beginning. And all I can say to that is, if I was going to take a bus from San Francisco to New York and the bus was going to stop in St. Louis, and you told me that the bus has no engine in St. Louis, I wouldn't get on the bus. Because I don't see how it's going to start going again once it stopped. The only time it had an engine was when it was in San Francisco.
Right. So now everyone wants to know what's going to push the bus. And this is very exciting, because I love how you explain it in your book, that the blood actually pushes itself. And
Yeah. And
people can't realize that. And I do mention that in the book. You also say that it solves the understanding of why water can climb a 300-foot tree against barometric pressure, and that it climbs itself. And so the blood is able, through what's known as the fourth phase of water, and that's a fairly new concept discovered by a professor at the University of Washington, to understand that there's actually an electrical charge that happens between 2 different parts of the water within the artery, or within the veins or capillaries, that there's a part of the water very close to the lining that separates itself. It's called an exclusion zone, and it has a different ionic energy than the main body of the blood running down the center. And so the differential creates an electric charge that actually moves the blood along. I might be incorrect about what I just said, but that's my understanding from what you've written in the book.
Yes. The only thing I would correct about that is it's the separation of charges you're talking about through the inherent properties of this fourth phase of water. That's not actually what moves the blood. What happens is then you essentially compress positive ions or protons into the water. So you have a negatively charged gel juxtaposed against a positively charged, positive charges dissolved in, you know, water, free-flowing water. Those positive charges repel each other, and that creates flow. You can see that in any tube. You know, you can see it on YouTube even, which is, a kind of a tube. You can see it on YouTube. You can do the experiment yourself, and you can create flow just through the exclusion of through the creation of this separation of charges you're talking about. And that's a unified principle in how you create flow in any tube, which, as you say, explains the movement of the blood in our bodies, and it explains the movement of the sap in the trees and anywhere else that water flows. And it also then tells you that the primary reason for the movement of the blood is inherent in the blood, and that what the heart does is basically an impedance device. In other words, in plain English, it stops the flow of the blood, or at least slows it down. And that's exactly the principle of how hydraulic pumps work. And it's a much more efficient way. And interestingly, even if you do, you know, one of the paradoxes in cardiology is most people would think, okay, what percentage of the blood comes out of the heart with each heartbeat? And most people would say 100%, you know, whatever comes in comes out. It turns out the ejection fraction is about 60% even in a normal person. In other words, for any one heartbeat, only 60% of the blood comes out of the left ventricle. That's normal. And that makes no sense from a pressure propulsion pump model. But every single hydraulic ram, you can set the gain, so to speak, and the ejection fraction is anywhere between 20 to 60%. If it's functioning optimally, it's 60%. You can turn it down so only 20%, and that's the exact range of ejection fraction in human beings. If it's optimal, it's 60%, and if you got a sick circulation, and I specifically say circulation, not heart, but if you have a sick circulation, it'll go down to 20%, which is exactly the range that you see in hydraulic rams, which are impedance devices. They're not pushing anything.
Now let's
talk about our whole model of circulation is crazy.
Yeah, I want to move us along, because I want to get into the heart attack function, where what you show in the book is that the heart actually pumps in a very dynamic geometric way that has a torque purpose to it, and it needs, the blood does need that, so it works, you know, in a way that helps the blood be this special self-moving energy.
Right. The reason the heart is arranged like it does with this crazy muscle fiber pattern is because what the heart is doing to the blood is creating a vortex. And the vortex creates an energy field around the heart, just like it's shaped like a torus. And, you know, you can actually measure it. And that does a lot of things that are positive to the blood and with the blood. It arranges the cells down the central axis. It creates energy for the entire body, et cetera. And so if you really look at the heart and how it's shaped and arranged, it's a vortex-creating device, period.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's not recognized, even though Leonardo da Vinci said it, and it was proven by Johns Hopkins not so long ago that he was right, that there are many different vortexes created in both sides of the heart, and that's really what the heart is doing.
So let's talk about heart attacks, because what happens is that, according to your understanding, we know that the typical in the medical world, they talk about blockages in the arteries, and if it's blocked, then the blood doesn't get to the heart enough, and the heart will stop or be upset. But what you're talking about is this much more about the dynamic nature of the heart and how that can be upset by different stresses that have to do with the ability of the heart muscle to pump itself due to how it's fed by food. What feeds the heart? And if it's fed with the wrong food, then it loses its ability to contract properly. Is that true?
Well, that's not exactly how I would say it. I mean,
no, I was simplifying it. But I what I meant is that if it's too acidic, then the muscles can't work properly. The mitochondria can't actually do their work if there's a calcium problem with it. So the acid from stress doesn't allow the heart to be fed properly so that the muscles can pump properly.
Yeah, except they're not pumping. But
okay.
But the bottom line is that the normal theory of why people get heart attacks is there's blocked artery, as you say, and the blood doesn't get through. The problem with this, and again, so here's another website called heartattacknew.com, and if you go to the, there's a lot of information on that, and there's a 170-page treatise by a pathologist named Baroldi who goes into this in gory detail. It turns out that if you examine people who've had heart attacks, approximately 41% at most have a blockage in the artery leading to the part that had a heart attack, which immediately begs the question of what happened to the other 59%. And, you know, this has been debated for the last almost 70 years because everybody knows who studied this even a little bit that not all people who have heart attacks or angina have a blocked artery. And there's a whole lot more you can say about that, but we don't have much time. But what I say is that instead of the one reason why people have heart attacks, there's actually three. One is they could have a blocked artery, particularly in certain bad places. But that's not the most important reason. The important reasons are the capillary blood flow, which is not spoken about or recognized in conventional cardiology, of which, again, if you go to heartattacknew.com, you will see abundant evidence of that. And then the third reason, and probably the most important, is in all heart attacks, there's a switch in the fuel that's used by the heart, and that creates a buildup of lactic acid in the heart cells, similar to how lactic acid builds up in the leg or the foot or whatever, and then you get a cramp. But in the heart, unlike the foot, you can't stop. The heart can't stop contracting, not pumping, but contracting. And the lactic acid builds up. It creates an acidification of the tissue, which then destroys the tissue, and that's what we call a heart attack. And that is the final common pathway to all heart attacks. It's exacerbated by a decrease in parasympathetic nervous system activity. It's increased by sympathetic nervous system activity, otherwise known as stress. It's exacerbated by a diet rich in sugar, and it's reduced by a diet rich in good fat. So, and in very specifically, there is a medicine called strophanthus, is the plant, that breaks down the lactic acid, converts it into a fuel called pyruvate, and basically breaks the entire cycle, and has been used to prevent and treat heart attacks for, you know, at least 100 years, and in Germany for extensively for decades. So thinking about this and understanding it differently changes one's relation to stress and blood movement and diet. Instead of a high sugar poisonous diet like most Americans eat, you do a natural food, liberal fat, high vegetable, low carbohydrate diet, and you think about taking simple non-toxic medicines like strophanthus instead of toxic stuff like statins, and et cetera, that don't do you any good in the first place.
That's great. Now, the diet is very important, but there are people who don't believe in fats. And for instance, there's a doctor, I think it's Esselstein, who is a vegetarian doctor who tells people to stay away from proteins and fats and be strictly vegetarian. Whereas your background has a lot to do with Weston Price, which is so much about fats and protein.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
The difference is the way we see it and our understanding of the process. And he, in my mind, erroneously thinks it's all about the plaque, and I disagree. Okay. And I think, look at, the history of people who don't have heart attacks. I would defy anybody to name one group of humans who had normal cardiovascular health all their entire life in the entire culture or society and were vegans.
Okay.
I can tell you that never existed.
Right.
Which means they're doing an experimental program on people, doing a diet that has never been successfully done on any group of human beings ever in history. I want to emphasize that. If you say, no, humans, their normal diet is a vegan diet or a raw foods vegan diet, the next question you should ask that person is, okay, which group of people did that and how did they do? Because the answer to that question is nobody did that and we have no idea how they will do.
Good.
Now think about that for a minute. There's been no successful human culture ever that has done those dietary recommendations. And, you know, sometimes, because I have a tendency to be a smart aleck, if somebody says that, I have on my iPhone, I have a picture of Buffalo Bull Backfat, who is a famous Plains Native American chieftain. His portrait hangs in the Smithsonian. He was apparently around 70 when they did that. His group of people were well-studied, no cancer, no heart disease, long, vigorous lives. And so I say to these people who advocate these vegan diets or raw vegan diets, okay, imagine you're giving a lecture in front of Buffalo Bull Backfat. By the way, as far as I can tell, the reason he was named Buffalo Bull Backfat is not because he was a vegan. But imagine the lecture in front of him and his group, convincing them to stop eating buffalo, that really they should eat broccoli.
Yeah, that would work, right.
Like,
but broccoli's good for you. It's just that... You also could use some buffalo.
What?
Broccoli is good for you. I'm sure that you grow some.
I do grow some. I eat a wide variety of vegetables almost every day. In fact, I wrote a book called How and Why to Eat Vegetables. And I advocate that traditional people actually ate 110 vegetables a year on average and about 15 different ones a day. And I do that and I advocate for that and I explain that in the book. And I even started a company that takes wild and perennial vegetables and hard to grow vegetables, and we grow them organically, wild, et cetera, harvest them, and we make them into vegetable powders, which you can use to augment your nutrition and flavor your food. It's called drcowansgarden.com. So I like vegetables, but there is no people who lived only on vegetables. It's actually a horrible misconception of the role of vegetables in the diet. The role of vegetables is essentially like vitamin mineral supplements, phytonutrient supplements. That's why we should eat lots of different ones in small amounts. The role of the plant, the proteins and fat need to come from animal food. That's the traditional diet. It's the same pattern everywhere. Every group that had no heart disease followed the same pattern.
And we need healthy food to do that. There's a lot of animal products out there that are not healthy. So if we get, you know, organic farms, grass-fed animals
there that aren't healthy either.
Right.
So yeah.
Yeah, so people should look for the best quality of dairy and meat and vegetables. So
and carrots and grains, et cetera.
Right.
It's all about quality.
Right. Now, we're getting to the end of the show, Dr. Thomas Cowan. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. How can people follow up and go to, I guess, and go to humanheartcosmicheart.com, right?
And if they want to go to the... check out our other endeavor. It's Dr. Cowan's, drcowans, garden.com. And then they will know everything they need to know about me.
That's great. Tom, thanks so much for being the guest on Energy Stew. This is incredibly helpful.
And okay, thank you.
Sure. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thank you so much for listening.